be and not very friendly for the staff or the patients. Lots and lots of rules and regulations. And those got dropped. Let's make it more comfortable. Let's make it more like home, although I would say it deteriorated to a place that hospitals often are not like home anymore. They're far dustier and dirtier. So less emphasis on hand washing, less emphasis on cleanliness, and less attention to isolating patients that had transmissible diseases. And antibiotics were used like water. They were used very widely for infections or for fevers without any knowledge of infection being present. What resulted from that was massive alteration of normal flora and the emergence of resistant bacteria. Now, what I've talked about up till now is history, and if you're worried about your exams, you're not going to get questioned on history. It's not a history test. Now we're starting the modern era and what's important today in infection control. There were alarms coming out. There was increasing transmission of resistant bacteria. And at one point, towards the end of the last century, the situation existed where the bacteria were winning. They were developing resistance faster than the drug companies could make new antibiotics, and certain infections turned up that were really not treatable. This was scary, and containment became an issue again. While hospitals were struggling with what to do about that problem, SARS came along and showed us how important it might be if new pathogens got imported into a country and with causing a disease that nobody knew anything about. It was an alarm. And especially since SARS was a problem mainly in hospitals. There's been concern since about 1990 that we're due for a new pandemic of influenza, and people kept looking for a candidate. And in 2003, avian flu came along in the East. It's an H5N1 virus. When it did infect humans, it was quite lethal, and so there was a lot of concern about were hospitals prepared to deal with patients who might have influenza during this deadly pandemic that was being expected. Here in Quebec, shortly on that, I remember saying at the time, I'm tired of worrying about respiratory infections and where we're going to put the patients who are coughing. I hope the next crisis will be diarrhea. Well, you always have to be careful what you wish for, because we got it here in Quebec with massive problems in hospitals with hospital-acquired Clostridium difficile diarrhea because of the evolution of a new, more virulent strain. All of these events brought about a lot of publicity, and suddenly infection control became high profile. Before that, hospital infections, well, you expected them to happen. Nobody cared because that didn't make headlines about them. Now each hospital has been looked at with a magnifying glass. If something goes wrong, you're sure that it's going to get into the media. So that's where we are, and that's why this whole issue is much more pertinent now, or will be to you when you get into hospitals, because the media and the population is sensitized. Just to look at some of these issues, you see here back in 1995, the years don't show up well, but it's 1995 to 2007, MRSA infections were very rare in Canada. You see how those rates increased almost exponentially up to 2007, the red line being all infections, the blue being those that were acquired in hospital. So not only now do we have infections in hospital, but we have some that are spread in the community. It's an example. We could show similar graphs for vancomycin-resistant enterococcus and other organisms. SARS, just to remind you, in case it ever comes back, it appeared, it was recognized in the spring of 2003. The first cases were traced back to November 2002 in China. It spread worldwide, but in very small outbreaks where it did spread, with Toronto being one of the more highly hit cities. And it had an extremely high mortality rate, at least amongst the cases that were recognized. But even more important in terms of the impact was the impact it had on healthcare workers. We haven't had outbreaks in the past where healthcare workers were so highly affected as with SARS. And so it caused a lot of panic in hospital situations. It came to Canada in February 2003, disappeared by July. It was mainly in hospitals. You can see here the numbers from Canada, mortality rate from Canada. Most of the healthcare workers did not die. The mortality rate was higher in the patients who acquired it, but nevertheless, three did die. SARS left us with two things. We need to be aware of the risk and the consequences of bringing in new pathogens into the country. It's important, especially when patients are coming in with respiratory infections, but perhaps with other infections as well, ask them where they've been. For the year after SARS, we did that at the children's. Children don't travel that much. It is amazing what proportion of the children who came into hospital during that six-month period, which covered the spring, summer, and early fall, had traveled to other countries. So, yes, Montreal is a city of travelers and immigrants, and it is important that you know if your patient has been somewhere unusual in the last couple of weeks in terms of what you might worry about. The other thing that came in was the concept of respiratory etiquette. We'll get to this a little bit later in the session, but it's putting some of the responsibility for prevention of transmission onto the infected person themselves rather than the healthcare worker. Avian influenza started in 2003, very large epidemic in birds in Asia. It's the largest known epidemic in poultry ever. The epidemic in wild birds has now spread to most of the world except the Americas. It's not come over here yet, or at least it's not established itself. It's a new strain. It's more pathogenic than previous strains. And the important thing is it can be transmitted to humans with a very high mortality rate, but it is still a bird virus. It doesn't transmit easily from human to human. Most of the cases have been those who had contact with sick poultry. And so we're not dealing with a pandemic here, but this was the strain that was predicted. And the fear was this high mortality rate. And lastly, what is Clostridium difficile diarrhea? I'm sure you've heard about this as well from somewhere else. This is a bacteria that's found all around us. It's in the dust, it's in the soil, it's in stool, especially in stool of children, but probably most people can carry it at some time in their stool. And it usually doesn't cause us any trouble. It's a spore former, so the spores are resistant to drying and they persist on surfaces. Antibiotics enhance the growth of this bacteria, so if you have a sick patient in hospital with antibiotic treatment, this bacteria has a chance to grow in the gut where normally it's suppressed by other organisms. And the disease is not caused by the bacteria but by the toxin that it produces. The problem that happened in Quebec in 2003 was due to the evolution of a new strain with a very potent toxin that caused much more severe disease, lots of very florid diarrhea, and once the environment gets contaminated from these diarrhea stools, it's very difficult to get control of it because the spores are resistant. This is the situation in Quebec. You see the green line pre-outbreak going up there in 2003. Then measures were brought in. Some control went back up again the next season, more control measures, and it's been back to baseline. And if I had the graph for the past 2 years, it would be back now to where it was pre-epidemic. But it did cause a lot of concern and a lot of changes in hospitals in how we manage the environment. Just a quick word about the pandemic, which did come. So pandemic comes when we have a new strain of human influenza. That's why the avian influenza doesn't count. I just want to point out on this slide that for the first time, 2009, we didn't call the flu after the country where it was first recognized. I think for politically correct purposes, we called it after the poor animal on which it was blamed, and it's not clear at all that the pigs were responsible for this. So pandemic last April, I'm sure you all know, you probably all lived through this. Well, you must have all lived through this. Very rapidly after it was recognized in Mexico, there were cases in Canada and in Montreal because last spring a bunch of schools decided to send children to Mexico for Easter break, for spring break, and so they brought back swine flu. It was a rapid spread to many countries. A pandemic was declared, second wave last fall, and mass vaccination, as you know, at the end of 2009, or actually November 2009. What do we know about this new disease? Well, it's not so new. It's an H1N1. We've had H1N1s around all along. It's just a new type of H1N1. Does it really count as a pandemic? It's not an entirely new strain. It is different enough that the only people who might have some immunity are those who are over 65, because there's some resemblance between this and a virus that was around many years ago. But the virulence is similar to regular influenza. The transmission is similar to regular influenza. The difference is because most of the population was not immune or had no partial immunity, a lot of healthy young people got sick. However, it wasn't the pandemic we were planning for, and I think this quote from Science is quite apt in describing what we all went through during that time. So that's where we are in terms of what's been going on that caused concern about infections in hospital. Let's look at what these infections actually are. The ones that make the headlines are not necessarily the ones that we're dealing with from day to day. I might call these infections different things. The current correct name is healthcare-associated infections. They used to be known as hospital-acquired infections. They used to be known as nosocomial infections. If I say any of those things, I'm talking about the same thing. So, are they common? Yes. This is current data from Quebec in 2006. 10% of all admissions to healthcare, acute care, acquired an infection. United States, 2002, different surveillance system, 5%. There's a study from Canada from 2006, also 10%. So they are common. You're going to see them when you're in the hospital. The mortality rate is significant and the cost is tremendous. Where do they happen? Right where you're going to be for the next few years. In the teaching hospitals, in tertiary care hospitals, and in larger hospitals. The reason for that being that that is where the more fragile, the more ill patients are, and where the more complex medical care is carried out. So not because these hospitals are worse at controlling infections, but because of the type of patients that are found there. Within these institutions, the rates are higher in intensive care units, transplant units, and oncology units, again, because that's where the more fragile, high-risk patients are. Risk factors for acquiring an infection in hospital include underlying illness. Of course, patients that are immunocompromised are at risk for infections wherever they are, in hospital or out. Those with metabolic and circulatory disturbances are at risk as well. Very young and very old, because the immune system is not functioning so well at those times. Where there is interruption of the normal barriers, the skin and the mucous membranes that try to keep infections out. And when foreign materials have to be implanted. These are the major risk factors. What's been going on in recent years? Despite attempts to control these things, infection rates keep going up. What happens is the types of infections change. As we manage one lot, another risk factor comes in. It's related to the increasing complexity or severity of illness in patients that get hospitalized. Some years back, patients were hospitalized for relatively minor illnesses that are now treated in ambulatory care or at home. So those that are ending up in acute care hospitals are very sick and often have severe underlying problems. Also, we're dealing with a much more immunocompromised patient population, and hospitals in the future need to be built so that you can assume that every patient there could be immunocompromised. We're doing a lot more transplants. There's a lot more aggressive chemotherapy than there was in the past. Use of immunomodulators for a whole bunch of diseases where they were not used before. HIV infection has added somewhat to that group, but less so now because most patients with HIV stay healthy. Increasing use of invasive devices, for sure, major increases there. And again, increasingly complex surgery for things that would have been considered inoperable before. We see this especially, well, I guess it occurs in all age groups, but in pediatrics, a lot of congenital malformations that would have not been repairable are now repairable, but they do require quite complicated surgical procedures, and this puts the patient at risk. So as we control some diseases and get control over some risk factors, we're bringing into the hospital more and more high-risk patients. I think the burden of these infections is obvious for the patient. They stay in hospital longer, they're sicker, they may die. For the institution, there's the direct cost of care, but there's also an important cost of litigation, and that's something that's increasing over time, perhaps more dramatically in the United States than here. So that's the burden of illness imposed by hospital healthcare-associated infections. Let's move on to what are the major infection sites. This is data from two large surveillance systems in Canada and in the United States. And despite our concern about the headline makers, you can see here what types of infections usually turn up. Urinary tract infections, the main ones. Surgical site infections, pneumonia, and bloodstream infections are the other three important ones. In Canada, the surveillance signaled out Clostridium difficile diarrhea. In the United States, that's included in other. So let's look at the four big ones, urinary tract infections. How do they come about? Usually they're associated with urethral catheters, almost always. So what happens here? A catheter is placed into the urethra, goes into the bladder. It's impossible to remove all the organisms from the urethral meatus. It's a mucous membrane, it's covered with microorganisms, that's normal. So with time, those organisms crawl along the catheter or grow along the catheter and will get into the bladder. And if that catheter is left in place long enough, inevitably there will be an infection. So not only infection in the urine, but very often then the organisms will spread secondarily to the blood and cause a bacteremia. And urinary tract infections in hospital are a very high reason for using antibiotics. So a lot of antibiotic use to manage these infections. No real easy way to prevent this other than get the catheter out. So when you're in the hospital and you have a patient with a catheter, you need to make sure that it only stays in as long as it's absolutely necessary. Don't forget it's there and just leave the patient with it. Surgical incision infections are the most costly of all because not only do they extend hospitalization, they require antibiotics, but very often they require more surgery to go and fix up the complications from that infection. Underlying health problems put the patient at risk for surgery infections, but most of the risks are associated with the surgery itself. So is the skin properly prepared with antiseptic before the surgery? Should the patient get antibiotics just before the surgery or during the surgery to reduce the likelihood of those skin organisms getting into the wound? Because that's where most of the infections come from. It's organisms from the skin that get into the wound at the time of surgery. The duration of surgery. If it's a very long procedure and the abdomen is open for several hours or the thorax, of course there's more opportunity for organisms to get into the surgical field. Most of them are not, again, coming from the operating room, they're coming from the patient's skin, but they do get spread from the skin into the operative area during the surgery. The type of surgery, of course, any surgery that crosses mucous membranes or gets into the intestinal tract is going to have a high risk of infection just because that's an area that's already quite extensively colonized with organisms. And then if there's damaged tissue left behind or if you've had to implant foreign material, those add to the risk. Antibiotic prophylaxis is not recommended for all surgery. It's recommended for surgery where the risk of infection is high. That's a situation where you're cutting across a mucous membrane. You cannot sterilize it, or you cannot, sterilize is the wrong word, you cannot make it antiseptic. Where you're cutting through skin, that's considered to be clean surgery, you can decontaminate the skin with antisepsis. And if the surgery is for a short time, you should be able to prevent organisms from the skin getting into your incision. But when it's a clean surgery where you can use antiseptics, if the risk of infection is very, or consequences of infection is high, you will use antibiotics even if the risk is low. An example there would be if you're doing open heart surgery, you're cutting through skin to get into the thorax. This is all clean material, but the risk of an infection, if it does happen, is high, or the consequences is high. Same with implanting prosthetic joints. It's clean surgery, but if that joint should get infected, it's a major surgery to remove it. So the two criteria for using antibiotics before and during surgery are those. It's very important that the dose and the time are correct. I hope you will learn about this when you're in your surgery rotations. It is usually not done properly. Antibiotics given too early, if you give them 2 days before, you just change the flora, so what's there is not what was there when you started the antibiotics. If you give them 2 hours before, 3 hours before, there may be no antibiotic left by the time you're making your incision. You need to give close to the time of making your incision so you've got maximum amount of antibiotic in the bloodstream at the time the cut is being made, and you need to maintain those high levels throughout the surgery. And there's another place where we see mistakes. The surgery might last 8 or 10 hours. Antibiotic is given at the beginning, it's gone with 2 hours, and the patient is unprotected for the rest of the time. So dose and time, and dose needs to be high. This is important because now accreditation are looking at these things and they are accrediting surgery on the basis of whether the antibiotic was given properly. Pneumonia associated generally with endotracheal intubation and mechanical ventilation, and it has the highest mortality rate of all HAI. You can see here the patient is intubated. There's a tube going down into the trachea, bypassing all the natural defense mechanisms and leaving bacteria from the oropharynx able to get down into the lower respiratory tract, either through the tube or around it. It has the highest mortality rate, and it's also the most difficult to prevent. Most people don't intubate a patient unless they absolutely have to. There are some newer non-invasive modes of ventilation that are being used more and more now. But in a lot of situations, there's no choice but to put the tube in. There are a few measures like elevating the head of the bed and a few other things which might help to somewhat reduce the risk of this infection, but most of them don't have a large impact. So a lot of room here for research and work in the future to try to reduce this risk. And lastly, bloodstream infections of the big four. These have a high mortality rate. They're almost always associated with intravascular catheters. Here you see a triple lumen catheter going into a vein. It goes through the subcutaneous tissue into a vein here. This is a device that anchors it to the skin so it doesn't move. You can see there's inflammation around this site, inflammation around the anchoring device. It's all a bit of a mess. Very easy for bacteria from here to grow along that catheter. There's a very small space between the skin and that vein that the catheter is inserted into, and the bacteria get from there into the bloodstream. This is the major way that bloodstream infections occur. They may also occur if back here somewhere there are stopcocks and valves that need to be opened to connect different fluids or whatever when you're treating your patient, and if you don't handle this appropriately, when you are changing your infusion fluids, you can get this contaminated and then the organisms go through the catheter. The site itself needs to be kept very clean. Antiseptics are used, antisepsis for cleaning the site so that infection doesn't develop there. You can also get a bloodstream infection if the material you're infusing gets contaminated. You have a contaminated antibiotic or blood product or IV fluid. That used to happen in the past. Most of these products are now prepared under very good pharmacological techniques, avoiding the risk of having an infection at base, but some still manage to slip through it, especially in some countries where the manufacturing procedures might not be as well scrutinized as here. They may sell to a bunch of hospitals a batch of intravenous dextrose solution that's contaminated, and then lots of patients will get infected. But that's less of a problem for us. Cancer patients can get bacteremia not because of a line, but because their mucous membranes and skin are broken down from the chemotherapy, and the bacteria have easy access to the sterile body sites. Okay, we'll move to what organisms cause infection. I don't think you need to remember a whole lot of organisms at this point. Just these are the major players, and you will see that they overlap between the big four infections. So for bloodstream infections, gram-positive cocci, which are blue because that's gram-positive, mainly staphylococci and enterococcus. Candida, which is a yeast, becomes important in terms of bloodstream infections in hospitals, usually because the patient has been on antibiotics, wiped out their normal flora. The candida grows either on their skin or in their gut, and they get infected with that. And then you have down below the gram-negative rods, the main ones that cause infections in hospitals. They're not so important in bloodstream infections, although they do occur. We're talking about primary bloodstream now, not bloodstream secondary to an infection somewhere else. Surgical site infections, again, you will see that the gram-positive cocci are important, but the gram-negative rods, Pseudomonas and E. coli, are playing an important role as well. Urinary tract infections, mainly gram-negative. Candida, again, very important player, and Enterococcus. And for pneumonia, in terms of gram-positives, it's mainly Staph aureus, but the gram-negative rods are very important causes of hospital-acquired pneumonia. So the same bunch of organisms in different proportions for different infections. In that large data bank of... that data was from a large surveillance system in the United States, by the way, that surveys several hundred hospitals. They found as well in that same year that 16% of all of the infections were due to multi-resistant organisms, mainly methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, vancomycin-resistant Enterococcus, and resistant gram-negative rods. All of these organisms were a little bit later to get to Canada than to the United States, but they're certainly proliferating in our hospitals here now. What about viruses? You haven't heard much about viruses, and yet in our major worry things, we had SARS, avian flu, and influenza. The reason it doesn't come up in the statistics is that most surveillance systems, at least in the past, didn't monitor for viruses. A lot of that had to do with the fact that many acute care hospitals don't have very good or any viral diagnostic techniques, especially in adult centers. And many hospitals before Clostridium difficile came along did not monitor for hospital-acquired diarrhea. Quite different if we're looking at pediatric hospitals and chronic care hospitals for adults, because in those situations, viruses are very common. They're common causes of hospital-acquired infections, both respiratory and gastroenteric viruses. Now that technology has advanced and many hospitals have access to PCR, the importance of viruses in adult acute care is being recognized more and more. Certainly, influenza is now looked for quite closely in adult sites. Norovirus is a virus that causes diarrhea more in adults than in children, and it has caused some impressive outbreaks in adult hospitals in Montreal. And with the new PCR technology that you want influenza, but you get tested for 18 or 20 viruses, they're finding a whole lot of other viruses that we have in pediatrics that are having important impacts in adults as well. So you're going to see some shift there over the years of what you're worrying about in the hospital, because you're going to be able to find these things. Just to show you some data from the children's, a 20-year period here, you can see all these are common respiratory viruses that we see. One-third of all the hospital-acquired upper respiratory infections and one-third of all of our pneumonias that were acquired in hospital were due to viruses. So this is not the ventilator-associated pneumonia that we talked about before that's coming out in the large surveillance systems. Okay, where do these infections come from? We have two sources. There are the patient's own flora, and then there's exogenous sources, other people usually, either patients most of the time or personnel, or the inanimate environment. Now, the inanimate environment has organisms of its own. Aspergillus, for instance, is found in dust and on surfaces, especially in our hospitals around here because they're very dusty. It's not a human bug. But the inanimate environment can also get contaminated from the humans. So the humans can put the Clostridium difficile spores onto the environment, and then the patient acquires them from there. Endogenous infections are because of a disturbance in the relationship between us and our normal flora. Where are our normal flora? They're on our skin, in the oropharynx, in the nose, a little bit in the stomach, more in the small intestine. Large amount, most of our normal flora are in the large intestine and in the female, in the vagina. And these are, generally speaking, the good guys. They live with us. They do some things for us. They keep out some of the invaders, and they don't cause a problem unless they get into the sterile body spaces, which are all these white areas. One of the normal flora that really can cause a lot of trouble in hospital is something called coagulase-negative staphylococcus, or staph epidermidis which is the major group in that category, normally lives on the skin and in the nose. It's one of our friends. It has the ability to make extracellular slime and adherence materials, and it loves plastic. Don't know why this bacteria would have evolved that way, but it likes to grow on plastic and other prosthetic materials. So it's really designed to grow on intravascular catheters and endotracheal tubes. What you see here is a scanning electron micrograph of coag-negative staph growing on an intravenous catheter. Each of those little roundish balls is a bacterium. It's a staphylococcus. This amorphous stuff here and some underneath here and over around here, this is the slime that this bacteria secretes, and it allows it to adhere well to the catheter, bury itself under this slime. In that situation, it's very well protected from the neutrophils and also from antibiotics. So it can become very difficult to eradicate this from the bloodstream, and often the catheter has to be removed. So a friend, but when it gets out of hand, it can cause trouble. This is just an example. I don't know how well it's projecting, but the number of invasive devices that might happen to a patient, if it's a trauma patient, it's intubated. Somewhere here, there's a nasogastric chew. There's one intravenous here. There's another intravenous line here. There are pins going through the skin into the bone to stabilize a fracture. And somewhere down here, there's a urinary catheter. And I have to try to find a better slide because this one's getting faded. It's old. But just to give you an example of any one of those sites, bacteria could get into sterile body sites because of all of these procedures. So that was the endogenous infections. Then there are the exogenous infections. There's the patient completely surrounded by sources of microbes. Mainly other patients may get there, not directly from the other patients, but by intermediaries such as personnel or objects. We talk about the routes of transmission of infection in hospital epidemiology a bit differently than in classic epidemiology. So if you see terms that don't seem to be used correctly, this is strictly talking about transmission within hospital situations. So infections can be passed from one person to another by direct contact between an infected and a susceptible person. Indirect contact is the main way that infections get around hospitals, where the organism is taken from the infected patient to the susceptible one via an intermediary, and that intermediary is most of the time hands. It's the major way these organisms spread. It could be your stethoscope, it could be a blood pressure cuff, or some equipment that's not clean between these two patients. And that is the major burden of transmission in hospitals. Droplet transmission, we're talking here about droplets that we spew out when we talk or sneeze or cough. Many organisms in these droplets are fragile. What happens to these droplets is some of them, the water dries out, and the little bit of material that's left behind, the residua, is very light, and it floats around in air currents carried here and there by the air. A large number of them will fall down onto surfaces around this person who is coughing or sneezing. If the organisms are very fragile, they don't survive up here, and they don't survive on the surfaces. If they do survive on the surfaces, then we get back into this situation where somebody comes along, touches the surface where these sneezes and coughs have landed, contaminates themselves, and gets infected. That's how most of the respiratory viruses get around, by this combination of droplet and contact. Airborne refers to organisms that can survive this drying. These are the hardest ones to control because they get carried around in air currents. They can go out the door, out the window, down the stairwell, through large areas of, depending on where the airflow is going, and very difficult to control. Over here we have common vehicle refers to when something gets contaminated. It could be food, it could be blood product, it could be a medication, and it's given to a large number of people, and what you get then is an explosive outbreak in your hospital. Doesn't happen very often, but when it does happen, it's a major concern. You've got to find out where this infection is coming from and make sure whatever product is contaminated is removed. We had an example of that in our hospital several years ago with salmonella that was coming from a custard pudding that was being served. So causes, it needs detective work as well to track down where it's coming from. Vector-borne in this situation refers to insects that are carrying infections in hospital, and this should not be happening in our hospitals. An example of virus transmission, this is a very important experiment that was done about 30 years ago now, on respiratory syncytial virus, which is a cause of bronchiolitis in young children and a cause of colds in adults. It was thought before that this got around by coughs. This elegant experiment was performed with three groups of volunteers. I think they were medical students. One group went into the room where the child was, the child with bronchiolitis, handled the child, played with the child, whatever, whatever. 71% of them got infected. The next group went into the room, sat a meter away from the child, didn't touch anything, nobody got infected. The interesting group were the third one. The child was not there. They went in, they handled the bedding, they handled the crib, they handled the toys, they handled things the child had touched. 40% of them got infected. And around that same time, it was shown that RSV can survive for several hours on surfaces. So the take-home point is you don't have to have the infected patient in the room there in order to pick up an infection. And then you may infect yourself if you inoculate your eyes or your nose from your hands, or you can pass that on to your next patient, even though there was nobody in the room at the time. And this is probably an important factor in all transmissions of respiratory viruses. In fact, there was an interesting paper that came out last year, just pre-pandemic, showing that influenza virus can be isolated in viable form from Swiss banknotes 2 days after they've been contaminated. So be careful how you handle your money. What about rotavirus? This is another virus that's easily transmitted. We see a lot of it in pediatric hospitals. If any of you have children, you know that they get this, they get diarrhea, and then the whole household gets diarrhea. The virus survives on surfaces. In this particular experiment, not so long. When it was in stool, it survived for over an hour, in water for less than 45 minutes. There are other studies showing with the proper temperature and humidity, it can survive for a day or so on hard surfaces. The problem with rotavirus is the amount of it in the stool. That electron micrograph is not purified virus. That is stool. And each one of those round balls is a virus. So it practically replaces the stool with itself. And you can see the number of particles per mil and how many viruses you need to get yourself infected or to transmit infection to another patient. And you can see why this virus gets around so well. You don't need visible stool. You don't need the child there. You just need a surface that's been somewhere in contact with something that child is contaminated. I think we're getting to the end of this section. Bloodborne viruses. We'll finish up, I think, with this part. A lot of concern, especially when HIV came in, about injuries to healthcare workers. In fact, with HIV came the notion that all blood should be considered as potentially contaminated because we could never tell in advance who might have a virus. We've extended that now to concern about other bloodborne viruses. Hepatitis B is the one that's most likely transmitted if the person who's injured is not immune and no prophylaxis is given. It was never of major concern, and I'm not sure why, because a lot of surgeons and a lot of dentists and a lot of other healthcare workers back in the days pre-vaccine did get hepatitis B, and some of them got quite sick from it. Nevertheless, it wasn't a major concern, and now, of course, with the vaccine, this shouldn't be a problem anymore. HIV has always been a major concern. The transmission rate is much lower. It's about 0.3% of those who have needle stick injury from contaminated blood will acquire HIV if no prophylaxis is given. Hepatitis C is perhaps more important. It's in between there. Again, not much concern about it, but it does happen, and healthcare workers do acquire HCV from injuries. What about the other way around? For a couple of decades or more, we've worried about healthcare workers acquiring viruses from the patients. But the fact that patients might acquire viruses from the healthcare workers has been pretty much, I wouldn't say ignored, but under the cover. And it's becoming more to the fore these days. These are estimates. Now, let me just backtrack. If you have a bloodborne virus or a healthcare worker has a blood-borne virus and it's going to infect a patient, a number of things has to happen. First of all, that person has to have a cut or a oozing or bleeding skin lesion of some sort, and that blood has to get into the patient's sterile body spaces or onto their mucous membranes or into an open cut of the patient. So where that is most likely to happen is in surgery and in dentistry. And that is where most of these events have happened. And in situations where the dentist or the surgeon is working in a small closed space with sharp instruments and can't always see where their hands are and may not know that they're getting cut. So the risk of transmission to patients follows the same likelihood as the risk of transmission from patient to healthcare worker. Most with hepatitis B, we should be able to fix that if everybody is immune. Hepatitis C next, we can't do much about that, and there have been a number of outbreaks now of hepatitis C from surgeons who are infected. HIV has been rare, but it has happened in a number of instances. Most of these transmissions, I think perhaps all, I'm not sure about hepatitis B, are from in situations where the surgeon didn't know they were infected. They were detected when the surgeon did get sick, and then there was a look back to see if any of that surgeon's patients were affected, or when a group of patients that were operated on by the same surgeon developed the disease, so they made an epidemiological link. We will go back to this later. I forgot to say at the beginning the structure of this session. In the second hour, I'm going to talk about infection control. Up till now, we've talked about the background. These are the infections that occur. The second half, we'll talk about infection control. Those are the measures we take to try to prevent infection. And I hope there will be time at the end to go over a number of case scenarios. And if there's time, maybe a little mini debate. So that will be the strategy for the next hour. If you want, we can go on. I don't know what you prefer to do. Who's voting for break? Okay. Well then, get up and do whatever you do during break. And we'll start again. We start at 20. Can we start at 25 too?
You mentioned that the main way was through hands.
Yes.
So wouldn't that be direct, though, hand-to-hand?
No. This is when the two people that are the infected person is in contact with the person who's going to get sick.
Okay.
Here, the hand is carrying the organism from this patient, and this is the one who gets sick. So it's transporting the organism from here to here.
Okay, so you mean hand, the hand and a surface, hand and something else, right?
No. Let's say we have a patient here who is not immune to influenza.
Okay.
Or who has influenza, and over here somebody is not immune. And I come along and I touch this patient, and then I go touch this one. I'm bringing the virus between the two.
Okay.
I'm carrying it. I'm not infected, but I'm just spreading it around.
And just one more thing. We have in our course pack some notes.
Yeah.
Should we be focusing on these, on the slides, on both?
Everything.
Okay. Yeah. Is there anything here that isn't covered in your presentation? Or?
Yes, there's some things. The main things are in this, but there's some things in here that are not in here.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry. I'm just wondering, I wasn't really clear on the point you were making with cutting through the skin versus cutting through the mucus.
Okay, when you're cutting through the skin, you can put an antiseptic and get rid of most of the bacteria, almost all of them.
Okay.
they'll come back, but you have time. You're doing your surgery before they'll go back.
Okay.
You can't do that with, say, you're operating on the mouth or something. You can't do that.
So when it, besides the mouth, are there any other situations where you're not cutting through skin?
Yes, you could be doing through the sinuses. You could be doing through the digestive tract, through the genital tract.
Okay, where you don't penetrate the skin and then it's harder to get.
Yeah.
Okay, and then I was just wondering what... SSI was?
Oh, surgical site, sorry.
Surgical site?
Surgical wound, yeah.
So these were the gram negatives,
yeah.
Is that what you were saying? So, and so should we know which ones are more associated with each disease?
I think not necessarily at this point. Mm-hmm. You probably learned about what causes urinary tract infections in general, and this is really no different.
Yeah, like we knew that we learned that E. coli was like the major cause of UTIs.
Okay. I think it's the concept that these same organisms are involved in these infections, but in somewhat different proportions.
Okay.
So gram negatives for UTIs, gram positives blood, etc. So, okay, it's more the principles at this point. Because you learn the bugs when you're actually getting the results back and treating
the
patients.
Thank you.
Okay?
Thanks.
Just looking for the... I had a specific question. I can't find it right now. But I also had a general question. In summary of your notes, and like things to focus on for the upcoming exam, is it important to know some certain statistics and details? Do you seem to cover a lot of those, or is it just sort of like prevalent?
Main things, important factors, I would say. You know, not the details, but how important are these infections, and you know, the big issues.
Okay. And you mentioned something about the bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like you sort of highlighted the top five. Should we know the top five for each infection?
I would say more the concept that gram positives are more likely to be causing these. Gram negatives are more likely to be causing UTIs. It's not so different, perhaps, from what you learn generally when you learn about UTIs and you learn about bacteria or bloodstream infections. I don't think the actual individual organisms are so important as the principles of where would you worry about. If it's pneumonia, you're going to worry about both.
Right.
If it's bloodstream, you worry more about gram positives. If you have to start treatment before you have the organism back, what are you likely to be treating?
Okay.
So the one that's important that covers both would be pneumonia.
Right.
Urinary tract is mainly gram negative. Surgical wounds also both.
Even though the enterococcus is still included.
Yeah, enterococcus is there, so that is important. But most, you know, the large majority are gram negative.
Okay, so most regions.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I'll go look for some water.
Questions.
Uh-huh.
The first one was, based based on the slides we were looking at in terms of the infection rates over the last year in the U.S. versus Canada,
mm-hmm.
it looked like it was about 10% in the U.S., sorry, 10% in Canada and about 4 or 5% in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And you were saying that the reason why you have more infections now is that you have some more serious cases in the hospital.
Yeah.
I would assume it's the same problem in the U.S., but for whatever reason they're doing better. Do you have any idea why they might be?
I would say that the numbers might not be statistically significant.
Yeah.
That the American data is from 2002. The Canadian is a bit more recent. It's 2006. The surveillance systems aren't always identical.
Right.
But I don't know if there's some increase over time.
There's some, sorry?
Increase over time.
Oh, okay.
Between 2002 and 2006.
Yeah.
We may be more critical in identifying them in Canada.
Surprisingly, because there's a much higher population in the U.S. too,
yeah.
So you think either the data is not completely accurate or they're doing a better job
yeah.
in some regard.
The other issue which influences the Canadian data is more of it, almost all of it, is from university teaching hospitals.
Okay.
In the United States, that 5% is from their data all put together.
Okay.
When they look at individual infections, they separate it out whether it's a teaching hospital or a community hospital.
Yeah.
But the overall rate, they put as
5%. Okay.
So that might influence it as well, that they're looking at more community settings.
Okay. The other question I had was, I guess we're going to talk about this in the next hour, but just listening to your talk for the first hour, it makes me just a little bit worried about going and working in the hospital because you feel like you're going to get
infected with
everything. What are you going to do? Is that what you're going to talk about?
Yes, the next part is how to control it.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm going to try to leave more time for questions, so I may go through some of this rather quickly and have more discussion.
Like apart from just constantly washing your hands, it seems like you're going to be exposed and susceptible to all kinds of things.
Yeah.
So, all right.
Well, you know that if you're going into a hospital situation, you're going to be exposed, but you'll need to know what to do to try to keep yourself healthy.
Yeah. Okay.
Washing hands is the most important thing.
Yeah.
And again, it's because we often don't pay attention to where we put our hands.
Yeah.
You see people going into the room and they're tired, they've been up all night, and some of our patients are in cribs, let's say, so they're leaning on the crib. They're not touching the patient. But that patient has diarrhea and has RSV, has been standing up with their little hands all over everything.
Yeah.
So it's important just to remember that around the patient that has an infection, there is infection as well. And it's important for yourself, but also then you might transmit that to your next patient if you just go on around the room.
Okay.
But you don't go into this business to avoid infections.
No, it's true. I mean, the tricky thing, too, is, like, in some ways it's clinically helpful to touch your patient to reassure them, you know, but you don't want to necessarily get super sick.
Yeah, but you won't if you wash your hands.
Yeah.
How are you going to get them into your body? You've got to stick your fingers in your mouth or your eyes or your nose. So the other people say, keep your hands away from your face when you're with your patient.
Yeah.
You've got skin lesions or something. It's a different story. You should be wearing gloves.
Right.
But if you get into the habit of, now I'm with a patient, and yes, you need to put your hands on them. It's a part of medicine.
Yeah.
But don't get your hands in your face until you've washed them.
Okay.
I'll try to remember to say that, but if I don't, you say it, okay?
Okay, thank you.
fed back to the institutions along with guidelines about what to do. One thing that I want to point out, though, and it's going to be very important in your interaction with patients, that not all infections are preventable. We think probably between 30 and 50% might be, but the rest are not. We should be able to keep patients from catching things from each other. Transmission of new organisms to patients in hospital should be possible, but it takes a lot of effort and a lot of resources. But it can be done. Some of the endogenous infections we cannot control today. Some of them we can control with meticulous technique. But what is encouraging is the numbers of improvements that reduce risk of infection that have happened in the last 10, 15 years are high, and this continues to go up. So we have better catheter materials that the bacteria don't like as well. We have catheters that are covered with antibiotics or antiseptics to try to prevent the bacteria from hanging onto them. One big example is laparoscopic surgery, where there's no big surgical incision, and that in most cases, surgery done through an endoscope has a lower infection rate than surgery done through an open incision. In cancer patients, we use growth-stimulating factors to enhance or speed up recovery of the bone marrow so they don't have such long periods of neutropenia. So a lot of things have improved, and they will continue to improve, and there's a lot of technology being developed here. So you're going to see a lot of changes that will reduce drastically some of the things we're dealing with today. Again, I mentioned before a lot of public interest, a lot of public awareness, and now the public misconception that all infections can be prevented, so they become very angry when something goes wrong. Anesthetists and surgeons for the longest time have had a practice of discussing ahead of time the risks of what they're going to do, and the patient has to be made aware of those risks and sign a consent saying, I want this procedure done. We haven't been doing that in other settings, and it's becoming more and more important to make sure the patients know ahead of time just the risk of picking something up in hospital. We can't make it zero. The risk of acquiring an infection when you're putting in a catheter, it's not going to be zero. If they know ahead of time, they might be less likely to get upset when it happens. They also need to see that we're doing our best. They need to know that if you washed your hands, and that's where the alcohol hand rinses come in handy, because you may have washed your hands down the corridor, but the patient doesn't know that. If you're washing your hands in the room or cleaning your hands, they know you're doing something. They need to see that your equipment is clean and that the environment is clean. So if, at least if they can see you're doing your best, then they're less likely to be upset. So for the care of patients in hospital, we have what are called standard practices, which are carried out for all patients. It assumes that anybody could have some infectious organism on their skin or in any of their body fluids, excretions, etc., to try to prevent transmission from one person to another. And then we have to try to prevent the infections with invasive procedures. What are these routine practices? Always wash your hands before and after contact with a patient. It protects you as well as the patient. Disinfect your equipment between patients. There are disinfectant wipes now outside patient rooms for you to clean your stethoscopes and your own personal equipment that you're carrying around. Use antiseptic procedures whenever you're doing invasive techniques. Make sure the skin is properly prepared ahead of time. For your own protection, handle sharp objects carefully so that you don't get needle stick injuries. For certain tasks where the risk of getting yourself contaminated is high, depending on what you're doing, you may need to wear gloves. If you're going to get splashed in the face when you're suctioning a patient or whatever, then you're going to wear face protection. And in some instances, you may need to wear a gown. This is for all patients, depending on what you're doing. A word about hand hygiene. You're all familiar now with alcohol-based hand rinses because they're all over the place. They've been used for many years in Europe, but they were very slow to get accepted in North America, probably because North America doesn't like to think that somebody else found something better. But they're certainly the method of choice. And the place to use them is at the point of care. So ideally, the hand rinse is attached to the patient's bed or attached to yourself. When you go to the patient, you pull it out, you clean your hands. You shouldn't have to go out into the corridor somewhere to look for it. These hand rinses have been associated with increased compliance with hand washing. People do it more often because it's easier. They don't have to go around looking for a sink. There's decreased infection rates when these are used. They're efficient and they're fast. Respiratory etiquette, I want to mention, because this is something that's become quite popular in recent years, and you saw this with the pandemic last year. Hospitals and all healthcare institutions have signs up. If patients have febrile respiratory illness, anything that could be a virus, they should carry out certain things, such as covering their nose and mouth when they cough or sneeze, dispose of their tissues, clean their hands, etc. This is kind of normal politeness or normal etiquette in a way, but it's something that many people have forgotten. And if possible, patients are advised to sit away from others if they're coughing, sometimes in a separate waiting room if that's possible. And the institution has to provide the materials needed for the patients to do this. We don't ask them to come with all these supplies. For those that are coughing, if it's possible, they should wear a mask. So that's what respiratory etiquette is all about, is what we ask the patients to do. When these measures are not enough to prevent transmission, we use what are called additional precautions, and these are based on the clinical presentation of the patient, considering what organisms we think might be involved. So for the contact transmission I talked about earlier, we need to keep the patients apart, hopefully in a single room. If you don't have a single room, make sure that the patients have no direct contact and don't share anything in that room. If you're going into the room to handle the patient, you wear gloves. You wear a gown if you're going to get your arms or your clothing contaminated with that patient's secretions, excretions, etc. Clean your hands with an antiseptic. After you remove the gloves are not perfect. They have little holes. It's been well documented that bacteria can get through the gloves. They reduce the amount of contamination of your hands, but they don't prevent it. And then equipment should stay in the room with the patient, or if that's not possible, it should be cleaned. For droplet transmission, remember the large droplets that don't go anywhere and they don't survive on falling down. It's simple. You wear a mask when you're within. It used to be 1 meter. Now there's talk of moving it to 2 meters of the coughing patient. Depends a bit on how forcefully that person is coughing. So that will prevent you from getting these droplets splashed into your nose and mouth. And the patient should wear a mask if they're out of the room. Airborne precautions are for those diseases that are spread by the airborne route. These are the most difficult to control because you have to control the airflow. So you need rooms with special ventilation and negative pressure so that the air goes into the room but not out. It's evacuated through special ventilation systems. And for these, this high-efficiency N95 mask is used. The disease you're going to worry about most, where you need to wear these masks, and at some point you're going to get fit tested in order to be able to wear them, is contagious TB. But if you have to go into a room of a patient with measles or varicella and you're not immune, you would use the same mask. Just a word about masks, because we've seen a lot about masks during the last year. They've been used for a long time. Up top is a model that was used for control of plague. Down the bottom is a surgical mask that we've used for years for preventing any kind of respiratory transmissions in hospitals up to 1994. The N95 mask, which you've, I'm sure, heard a lot about in recent years, was brought into healthcare from industry in 1994 when there were outbreaks of multi-resistant TB in healthcare workers in the States. The outbreaks were not because the surgical masks had failed. They were because patients weren't diagnosed and nobody was doing anything. But as often happens, there was an overreaction to this outbreak, and the people who were trying to fix the situation said the surgical mask is not good enough. We need these industrial masks. They were never designed for healthcare, and they're very uncomfortable to wear. But nevertheless, that's what's recommended now. They do require fit testing. It's a tight-fitting mask with a filter built into it. And they were used for SARS. They will be used for avian influenza. And they were recommended for the pandemic last year in the early stages and continue to be recommended for pandemic flu for carrying out certain procedures on patients that will generate aerosols. And you will learn more about those when pandemic influenza comes back, because it's not quite clear now what will be used for what. Just want to mention briefly the preoccupation with masks. Picture from 1918. There are a lot of pictures in the literature from the way masks were used in the 1918 pandemic. We went through pandemics in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, and this whole mask issue didn't come up. Suddenly, with a vengeance, with a pandemic this year, they've come back. It's not clear why. I don't know if it's because when you have a pandemic at the beginning of a millennium, you're wearing masks. I don't know. A millennium? No. Century. Sorry. But something changed. Still not known whether they're necessary or whether they protect. Just to say quickly what's recommended right now, which is not particularly logical. If somebody has seasonal flu, it's a surgical mask. Pandemic flu, a surgical mask with the N95 for certain procedures. And history shows us that what's pandemic flu 1 year becomes seasonal flu the next year. So what we're going to do, the people who make guidelines are still debating. I will finish up, go from here to what we want you to do, besides washing your hands. I mentioned to somebody, and I'll say it now because I'm going to forget, to protect yourself while you're with your patient. You need to touch your patient as a part of medical care. Keep your hands away from your face. You're not going to catch, but if the patient is coughing, you're going to wear a mask. If the patient's not coughing, you're only going to get infected from your hands if you put your hands in your mouth, eyes, or nose. And a lot of viruses can get in through the eyes. So make a practice when you get into hospitals, when you're touching your patients, don't touch your face until you've had a chance to clean your hands. You'll be okay. You won't catch RSV or rotavirus. So when you're admitting a patient, you need to screen them for a presence of contagious diseases and ask about recent foreign travel. When I say screen, you may be admitting a patient for a fracture, but they're coughing and have a fever. So you need to take that into consideration and take the appropriate precautions for that, even though that's not the main reason for coming into hospital. If you don't know what infection control precautions are needed, droplet, airborne, blah, 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 ask the nurses. They know. What they need to know from you is what you're worried about. So if all the nurse knows is that you're admitting a patient who has a fracture, they won't know that other things are required. If you say, oh, by the way, this patient also has a fever and a cough, then they will make sure that the proper precautions are done. And with time, you will learn in the different hospitals which ones you're supposed to carry out. The last item here is important. We often see people barging into a room, ignoring what's written on the door because they don't agree with it or they don't understand it. And that's very confusing for everybody, including the patient. So it may be that what's on that door, the sign saying you need to wear a gown or a glove or whatever, might be wrong. But if you don't think it's right, go find the person responsible for the patient and discuss it there. Don't just go in and break the rules because it's very disturbing to the patient. If you're going to put in a catheter somewhere, make sure that patient actually needs it. So before you do any invasive procedure, is it necessary? Most of the time it is, but just ask yourself that question. Is there an alternative to this? And while you're inserting invasive devices, handling or using or caring for invasive devices, make sure you use very good antiseptic technique. And then every day, ask yourself as you're doing your rounds, does this patient still need this endotracheal tube or this IV or this catheter, or can I take it out today? Often we find these get left in because nobody's gotten around to considering if it's needed. Oh, it was there this morning and I've been too busy all day to find out why. It's not good enough. It has to be assessed every day. Use antibiotics wisely. Don't use them just to cure fevers. And don't substitute treatment for a diagnosis. If the patient does have a multi-resistant organism, then you'll take the appropriate precautions, usually contact precautions, to prevent it being transmitted to somebody else. For your own health, have all the required immunizations. This is to protect you from acquiring these diseases from patients, but also to protect your patients, because if you're not immune and you get one of these, you could transmit it to the patients. Very important to get influenza vaccine every year. You're sort of ethically and morally obliged as healthcare personnel to do this. But pre-pandemic, we've had pretty dismal rates of compliance. There are some places that have made this mandatory now for healthcare personnel. I don't think we'll go that route in Quebec, but it is important to know that this is valuable for both you and the patient. Know what your PPD status is in case you get exposed in hospital. You need to know your baseline. If you have to work while you're sick, know what to do. Ideally, you would never get sick for 4 years or 5 years, or if you got sick, you could stay home. But sometimes you'll have to work with a cold. You have to work with a cold. You wear a mask and clean your hands. Ask the people around you if you have to work what you should do to prevent transmission. Take precautions against bloodborne viruses. Consider everybody could have some virus. Try to protect yourself from injuries, from sharps, the best way you can. There's newer technology out there now that makes this easier to do, and you'll see more and more of that. Better ways of handling surgical instruments as well to prevent people in the operating room getting injured. Make sure when you're in the hospital that you know about that hospital's post-exposure prophylaxis. If ever you were to be exposed and if HIV was a concern, you need prophylaxis right away. And all hospitals have a protocol for this and a system where you can get service 24 hours a day. You just need to know who to go to. Often it's the nursing supervisor if you can't find anyone else that can help you. The last point I want to look at a bit later know your bloodborne virus status and what to do if you have a bloodborne virus if you are going to do any invasive procedures. The situation in Quebec right now is that all physicians are supposed to know their bloodborne virus status, and there is a system in place which is confidential and can be anonymous where people can go for advice. What can I do? I have hepatitis C. What does that impact for my career? It is voluntary and is confidential. But there are places in the world where this is now mandatory. And in certain hospitals in the United States, testing of healthcare workers for bloodborne viruses has become mandatory. So we will see where that evolves. Okay, the next would be, I would like to spend the rest of the time going over some cases, but since I'm not giving you much time to talk, I thought maybe we could have some questions first, if there are things that aren't clear from what I've gone over so far, and then we'll look at the cases. Yes. For a urinary catheter? No, you can't really replace it every day, because for an IV line, you would run out of sites. And for a urinary catheter, again, the trauma of going in and out every day might be too high. Although, if you don't need it all the time, a quick in and out catheter is a common procedure if somebody can't urinate, they have retention. But no, you leave the IV in, but the care of that line every day is the care of the site. Make sure that the site is not infected. Use antiseptic technique for changing the dressings and whatever. But in adults, if it's a peripheral IV, you'll learn these details later. It's changed every, I think, 3 days, but for any other than a peripheral IV, they're left in until they're no longer needed or they don't work anymore. No. The alcohol alone, the bacteria grow back very, very quickly. It's a short-term thing. And bacteria don't become resistant to the antiseptics that we use. So, no, there's no credence to that. The only place where soap and water has been superior to, or not superior, yes, superior to hand rinses, is for getting rid of spores of Clostridium difficile, and that's because you've got to remove them physically. So when you use soap and water, you're removing things physically. When you use the alcohol, you're not. You're just rubbing things around. But no, it does not increase resistant organisms on the hands. And in places where they've been used for decades, this is the kind of thing that's been well studied. So the answer is no. Any other questions? Clear as mud? Anyway, okay. So, let's look at case one. You're taking care of a patient who is admitted with a head injury, who has a urinary incontinence because of this. He has a catheter in, and 5 days later, he has fever and is hypotensive. The urinalysis is abnormal. Obviously, you're going to do a urine culture. Is there any other microbiology test you would want to do? You want to know about white blood cells? Okay, you can do a CBC. Yep. That's not a microbiology test, but you can do it. Yeah? A blood culture. And I'm saying that because often patients with urinary tract infections have a secondary bacteremia, so just to make sure you're not missing that, especially since this patient is hypertensive. Of course, you're going to see if there's anything else going on that you need to worry about besides the urinary tract, but for sure, blood culture is important. Again, this gets back to the type of organisms we talked about before. If for empiric therapy, what organisms should you be concerned about in terms of groups? Gram-negative rods, mainly. In fact, if you just treat for gram-negative rods, you're probably okay, but there's a couple other things you might want to consider. Enterococcus and Candida. But another important point, which I didn't make in the talk or in the handout, is you also need to know what's hanging around. Let's say it's an intensive care patient. What's hanging around your intensive care unit? And do you have some multi-resistant organisms there that you need to worry about? So in addition to, from the literature, what you expect, when you're in the hospital, you need to know what's there as well. Could it have been prevented? Somebody's saying yes. How? How could it have been prevented? It may have been preventable. We don't know if this patient really needs the catheter. Okay? There should be very strict criteria for putting catheters into patients, and they should be required because of urinary incontinence or urinary retention, or you absolutely have to measure the amount of urine, not just for incontinence, because a lot of patients are incontinent, and putting a lot of patients at risk for infections is not a good idea. So you need to know, it might have been prevented, was this catheter really needed, and if it was, is it still needed 5 days after the injury? Okay, so for urinary tract, get the catheter out. This one's going to be a little more complicated. You're in the ICU, the patient had cardiac surgery. Patient is ventilated. 4 days later has a fever. What might be going on? Speak up. Okay, you've got a good point. The trauma of the operation could cause a fever. There's also something called the postcardial myotomy syndrome, which causes fever. So let's say we're looking for infectious causes, because drug fever and all that we will not talk about today. So you want to find out if this patient has an infection. So what might be going on in terms of an infection? Okay, somebody is saying a surgical site infection. Post-op, go where the money is. Go look at the surgical site. Is that the cause? Could be a number of other things. And I find very often that surgeons, especially that just spent 10 hours doing this complicated surgery, don't like to think that something went wrong. So they want you to look everywhere else, and you have to look everywhere else. But the surgical site is what you have to assess first. So sometimes you have to remove complicated dressings in order to be able to see the surgical site. And for cardiac surgery, you may need to do a cardiac echo to see if there's anything going on inside the heart. So you're looking at your surgical site, but what else is going on here? What else might this patient have? I can't see very well back there, so if anybody in the back has the question. What about the ventilation? Pneumonia. Okay, does the patient have a pneumonia? Most likely, 4 days after surgery, this patient has 5 or 6 intravascular lines. Could very well have bacteremia. And we don't know about the urinary catheter. Let's say this one they managed not to have a urinary catheter in, so we won't worry about UTI. But the point I want to make is make sure in your assessment for fever post-op that you look at the surgical site. That is the place that you have to eliminate first in terms of infections, and then you assess all the rest of it. Okay. Last December, known asthmatic is admitted with wheezing and cough and somehow managed not to have a temperature taken, which does happen sometimes. Next day he's much better, so he goes home. He was in a 4-bedroom. 3 days later, patient with chronic lung disease in that same room develops influenza. Could this have been prevented? Who says no? Who says yes? Okay, some say yes. Most people think they don't know. Okay. Well, what might have been done to prevent this? What would you have done in this situation? Yeah. Yes. The first patient with the wheezing and the cough should have had a temperature taken and should have been isolated. We're in the middle of a pandemic. Just because he's asthmatic doesn't mean he might not come in with something else. The first patient should have been isolated. What else might have been done? We're talking December. What happened last November? Louder. Vaccination, mass vaccination. Should this asthmatic patient have been vaccinated? Yes, one of the criteria. One of the major reasons for getting hospitalized, by the way, with H1N1 in older children and adults, healthy young adults, was asthma. Should have been vaccinated. What about the patient who caught influenza? Chronic lung disease. Should have been vaccinated. Okay. So this could have been preventable by having neither of them having influenza. And it could have been prevented if influenza had been thought of with the patient that came in with asthma. What are you going to do now? Isolate the one who has influenza now. What about the two remaining roommates? Say it louder. Somebody's saying prophylaxis, okay? Now, this is a controversial issue at the moment because that's what, in fact, we were doing early in the pandemic. If we had exposures like this, we gave prophylaxis to the others in the room. However, it was very quickly realized that prophylaxis was leading to development of resistance, and there were a couple of cases put on prophylaxis and then got infected with a resistant strain. So the protocol after that was not for prophylaxis. We would isolate those two patients as well because they may be cooking up influenza and treat them at the very first sign of anything, so early treatment rather than prophylaxis. But if there wasn't the concern about resistance, and early on when we were less concerned about resistance, we would have given them prophylaxis. So again, this is a bit subject to change right now depending on how things evolve with this new virus. Okay, this patient has perforated appendix, has surgery, gets better quickly, is about to go home, is all ready to go home, and has a fever, and her incision is opening up and draining pus. She is not happy. This happens all the time. What might have helped? What are you going to do when you admit your first patient with perforated appendix? Anybody up there has an answer? Oh, antibiotics, but antibiotics is not going to make her less angry.
Should we manage the expectations from the outset?
The expectations. Perforated appendix, high risk of infection. Make sure the patient realizes this might happen. Okay, at least it won't be a total surprise when it does. But yes, I'm assuming that she got the appropriate antibiotics for the surgery, and if she didn't, that would be a problem. But even with the appropriate antibiotics, once the perforation occurs, there's a much higher risk of intra-abdominal abscess as a complication of the surgery. Not of the surgery, but of the appendicitis. But if the patient doesn't realize that and thinks everything is fixed, then they really count the hours to get out of hospital. So having to stay for a longer time can be devastating. So make sure the patients understand what's going on, not just today, but during their stay. I usually like to give patients an overestimate because nobody's ever complained if they went home early. But if you say, oh, you'll be out in 2 or 3 days and it ends up being 2 weeks, they get very upset. So just to make sure that they're aware of what may or may not happen. This is the debate I would like some of you to start talking about. I'm not hearing a lot of talking, though. Because I think this is something that you're going to be facing. First question is, should all physicians be tested for bloodborne viruses? Who says no? Nobody? Who says yes? Who says don't know? Okay. I think the yeses have it. I think the fact that physicians should be tested has now been accepted. It may be that not all physicians need to be tested, but one of the problems is no matter what you're going to do in the long run, you're probably going to be doing rotations where you are involved with invasive procedures. So, assuming that... Is that a question up there? Yeah, sorry. With the light, I can't see. I'm sorry. Okay, it's a good question. I first wanted to get the part about yes or no, so I think most are with yes. So, should it be mandatory? And the question is, should it be mandatory with disclosure or should it be mandatory but confidential? Have I got that right? Yeah. Okay, so let's say it's going to be mandatory but confidential. So then we'll go to the second question. Should this be voluntary the way it is now here in Quebec? Or should it be mandatory? Who votes for voluntary? Nobody? Who votes for mandatory? Okay, this is interesting. Better tell the college that. Maybe they'll change their way of functioning. Because it's very difficult with a voluntary situation since nobody knows how many or who or if any people are actually getting tested. If it should be mandatory, then maybe I can hear from some of you how you would see it working. Any thoughts? Because maybe someone here could write the protocol for physicians of, 2012, 13? Yes. Yearly testing for TB, no. A baseline is done, and after that, it depends on where you're working. Okay, but yes, you could do a yearly test for bloodborne viruses, so you go to staff health once a year and get tested. You would want that to be known only to yourself, or should your supervisors know, or your boss, or your whatever? Once you know you've been tested and it's mandatory, if it's mandatory but only you know the result, it's still back to you to do something about it. So how is that information going to be useful? And it's a bit like the voluntary system now. The way it works is there is a service in Quebec that you can always get advice through McGill Staff Health, Student Health. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, we talked about that just at the end of the first session. And hepatitis B, as I say, should not be a problem because the vaccine is there. There may still be some people who unfortunately acquired hepatitis B before they were able to be vaccinated. The risks are there. Hepatitis, the risk is low, but it's not zero. So the way it works now is if you know that you have one of these viruses, you can contact the college or contact the Institut de Santé Publique de Quebec. They have a system where it can be anonymous. You can phone them up and say, I am hepatitis C positive and here's what I do. And depending on your description of what you do, they may say you need to either stop doing that or take certain precautions or nothing, because for a lot of people, you will not be doing any procedures where you're going to get your blood into contact with a patient. But one of the concerns is training programs where if you have a mandatory month or two of surgery, will you be able to do that surgery rotation? And that's where it impacts on trainees. And you may have to get exemption for certain rotations. And you may be advised not to go into surgery or not to go into a particular type of surgery. This is where, in a sense, it's important for you to know early on if you're infected with bloodborne viruses, because you may need to direct your career in different ways. It's not to say you won't be physicians. Most physicians will not transmit bloodborne viruses, but there may be certain directions that you would not go. Yeah. A person with HIV could? Well, now there's no rule. If you were to call up and say that you had HIV and you wanted to be a surgeon, there might be certain types of surgery that you would not be allowed to do. Okay? There would be decision based on what is the risk. There are other criteria as well. In England, where this has become mandatory now for physicians, if you have a non-detectable viral load for a certain period of time, then you can get permission to do whatever. With hepatitis C, that is being looked at, but it's much harder to control the hepatitis C viral load. But maybe with better antivirals for hepatitis C, that will be possible. Hepatitis B, you can get treated if you become antigen negative or the viral concentration goes down below a certain amount, then you get permission to do the procedures. That's all upfront and open because everybody has to be tested and they need this for licensing. Here it's a bit different because it's on a one-on-one basis. You would need to, if somebody had HIV and wanted to be a surgeon, that is where it might be very dicey as to which branches of surgery you would go into. Where transmission has occurred, it's been mainly orthopedics, thoracic, dentistry, of course, and obstetric, OBGYN, because in those fields you're working inside body cavities where you often can't see where your hands are. The more superficial or surface surgery where you know where your hands are, it's a little bit easier. People would be advised as to what they might or might not do. I don't have all the precise breakdowns in my head. So everybody going to rush off to student health services and get tested, or maybe you've all been tested already. But it is important to know if you're planning your career and not to be surprised later on. It is voluntary. It probably will stay voluntary here in Quebec because Quebec doesn't like to mandate this kind of thing. But if ever you were to infect a patient, then you would be liable because this advice is there that you should not do this. Okay, let's do one last case. This patient has been in this bed for 3 weeks with rubella. Should all these other people have a rash? What could have been done to prevent these others? Four people, the staff, the senior resident, the medical student, and the nurse in charge all have spots. What could have been done to prevent it? Two things. Vaccinate all this lot. Whoops, my fingers don't work. Vaccinate this lot and isolate the patient when he comes in. Okay, with that, unless there are more questions, we're finished. If there are more questions, I'm happy to answer them. Time to celebrate.